supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. A couple of awards were granted this year to honor those who are improving the way we care for individuals with mental health conditions. On today's show, we're going to hear from two of these award recipients about their innovative ideas, and we'll spend some time talking about the present state of the recovery movement. We're going to be talking about it with one of Philadelphia's leading advocates in the recovery movement, maybe nationally. We've got three guests this hour: Patricia Deegan, Arthur Evans Jr., and Molly Kreider Viscardi. Deegan does research and lectures on the topic of recovery and the empowerment of people diagnosed with mental illness. Our web application, Common Ground, received the Scattergood Foundation's 2013 Innovation Award, and she joins us by phone. Pat, welcome, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Where are you right now? Boston?
North of Boston, yes.
North of Boston. Well, congratulations on last night's Boston Red Sox game also.
Yes, indeed.
Arthur Evans joins us. He's here in the studio. He's the commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. His department is working on cutting-edge recovery models. Art, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In a little while, we're going to be hearing from Molly Kreider Viscardi. She and a team of students over at Penn won this year's Public Policy Challenge Award. They created an appointment reminder for those discharged from inpatient mental hospitals. We're talking about innovation today. What's new? What's being done? Maybe what needs to be done? We'd love to hear from you and your experience. Our number is 888-477-9499. What programs have you seen that makes a difference in people's lives? 888-477-9499. Pat, as long as we're talking about innovations, let's start with you. Tell us about the Common Ground web application.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Common Ground is a web-based application that helps people who are diagnosed with major mental disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar and schizoaffective disorder, who are receiving services, participate in making choices about what the best treatment for their recovery will be, and to make those decisions collaboratively with their treatment teams, with their care teams. I'm a person who was diagnosed with schizophrenia when I was 17 years old and have gone on to get my doctorate in clinical psychology and have spent my career carrying the message and the good news that it is possible to recover after a diagnosis of major mental illness. And what I felt was that although I was lecturing around the world and presenting people with a lot of really important information about how to support people's recovery, once people got back into the workplace, it's very difficult to enact those practices, those recovery-oriented practices, without the entire culture of the organization transforming. And so eventually I started my own company, and we develop web applications that help clinicians and help individuals with diagnosis begin a new kind of conversation and work together in very different ways.
So and the one application that I'm most aware of is the one, I think you did a YouTube video on it, or it's on your website, about what happens with patients as they wait to see their prescribing doctor. Tell us about that application that patients use in the waiting room.
Yeah. So Common Ground, again, is a web application, and people come in a half hour before they see their psychiatrist or their prescribing nurse. And during that half hour, rather than just waiting in a waiting area, people are greeted by other people who are in recovery, who are paid peer staff, and who invite folks to sit down at a computer terminal or to pick up an iPad and to complete a one-page health report for their doctor, for their psychiatrist, to review issues that are of concern to the individual. Hey, this medication is giving me sexual side effects, or is causing me to be too sleepy, or this medication is causing me to gain weight. And people use that half hour with peer support to prepare that concise one-page report, which the doctor can also see on the doctor's computer screen.
Let's back up a minute, Pat. Why is that needed? I want our audience to know why that is needed, because you think, well, you go into a waiting room and you know what you want to ask your doctor.
Well, actually, most people don't.
Uh-huh.
And I'm talking about everybody. We sometimes make mental notes. A tiny fraction of us actually take the time to write down a list of things we want to mention. But research has shown that the physician needs to cover so many topics in usually a very short appointment, 15 or 20 minutes, that the research tells us that there's literally 18 seconds after the doctor asks you, so how are you doing? 18 seconds later, the physician will interrupt and begin questioning you about the topics that the physician needs to cover in that time. You literally have to struggle to get a word in edgewise. And imagine if you layer on top of that what it's like to be have an anxiety disorder, or to be very depressed, or to be having cognitive issues that are making you feel more disorganized, right? You have trouble putting those thoughts together. And my thought was, well, what if computers are great at organizing things into concise reports. What if people take the time to enter their concerns half hour before seeing the doctor, and then let the computer do all the processing and crunch that data into a one-page report that then amplifies the individual's voice that appointment?
Let's go back to age 17 when you were diagnosed with schizophrenia. What was happening in your life then? And I'd like to hear a little bit about how you go from 17-year-old girl diagnosed with schizophrenia to a grown woman with a doctorate in clinical psychology making cutting-edge innovations.
Sure. Well, it's been an interesting story. But basically, you know, like most people with psychotic disorders, during my senior year in high school, I began to experience some very distressing experiences. I began to hear voices that were very unpleasant and saying cruel and commanding things to me. I began to suspect with increasing certainty over a period of days that people around me weren't who they claimed to be, that some sort of, at the time, I wasn't clear what kind of plot or something was going on, but that something that was not benign was going on around me, and maybe I was the last human left on the planet. I began to shout back at these voices. Clearly, that was distressing.
How did you get to a doctor? What was that?
Well, the adults around me obviously could see this change. It was not an immediate change, somewhat gradual, but within short order, they got me to inside a psych hospital. And I was diagnosed with schizophrenia and given very high-dose antipsychotic medications. But unfortunately, and I was told, take these pills. And I was also told that I was going to be sick for the rest of my life. And I was told that I needed to put down all of my projects. I was a really good athlete, 4 varsity letter athlete in high school. I was told to forget that. It was too stressful, they told me. Don't bother thinking about college. Really, you need to avoid stress, and you need to take medicine. And that is what I've come to call a prognosis of doom. Because now, on top of having to deal with the disorder itself, now I had been given a message by powerful people like doctors saying that, essentially, my future was eclipsed. My life is over.
So
prognosis of doom.
All right. Now, you're a 17-year-old girl, and these doctors are telling you their truth. I would think the vast majority of kids, that's what you were back then, would just listen to these grown-ups with all these credentials and simply accept what they said.
I did. Ah. And you know where that got me? Well. In other words, I did what I was told, and I approached treatment the way most Americans do. You pull into the car repair shop, and you get a tune-up. You get fixed. And that was my attitude. The doctors know best. I show up for treatment. I swallow the pills on command. I avoid stress by sitting in a chair doing nothing. And, hey, I should be getting better. Fix me. Fix me, doctor. And what I learned over the years, because by the ripe old age of 18, I was diagnosed with chronic undifferentiated schizophrenia, which is even a worse prognosis of doom. And by that point, I realized this is not working. I have to get active and help save myself. My doctor and I have to find a new, more collaborative way of working together. Or, because I can't, the despair of doing nothing. I mean, the bottom line is boredom, a life of no meaning, a life of no purpose, is profoundly stressful.
Yeah, if we had more time, I'd love to know about your family, your roots. I mean, what is it, was it in your heart and spirit that enabled you to kind of wake up and say, this is wrong? I don't know if that puts you in a minority or a majority. You can be in the middle of all this and say, hey, there's something wrong here. We've got to fix it. I just think that's wonderful. Obviously, it's life-saving.
I want to say that you know, myself and people like Arthur Evans and many other recovery champions literally around the world are beginning to raise the bar, the standard of care. We are saying that we know through longitudinal studies that half to two-thirds of people diagnosed with major mental disorders can and do recover, and that we must stop putting out this prognosis of doom. We need to approach people with hope, with a door that opens onto a future, back to work, back to parenting, back to school. Yes, with supports. Yes, with reasonable accommodations. But a life.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Arthur and I are up to, and so many others around the world, saying it is possible to have a full and meaningful life, even though you might be managing a psychiatric disability over time.
Yeah, I it's funny. I just wrote an article for the Huffington Post entitled "Hope That Hurts," and it's the kind of hope that I will be okay when I will be okay. When a quadriplegic walks again, or when someone with schizophrenia is cured, or when I have the right spouse, or when I can change my history. But, you know, the kind of hope you're talking about is hope that you can have a full, complete, happy life with this diagnosis.
Or in spite of.
Yeah. Tell me, do you still consider yourself someone with schizophrenia?
I experience myself as Pat Deegan, someone you know, who's recovered from schizophrenia. The way I look at it today, I live with certain vulnerabilities, and I'm sure they're not the same as yours, but I know you have them too. And that's been the beauty of growing and maturing over time, right? I used to think there was the world of the normal people and the world of people like me. And what I found out as I got to know people and as I grew more mature is that everybody lives with vulnerabilities. Everybody is managing vulnerabilities. And mine are perhaps different than yours, but it's about how well you manage them that really count.
Arthur, you've been very patient here, and I appreciate that. So Pat is kind of implying the phenomenon of recovery and what that really is. So you've become really a nationally respected leader in the recovery movement. Tell us what it is and what's really cutting edge about it.
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't think there's anyone who can articulate what recovery is about better than what you just heard from Pat. the recovery movement really is about reframing and rethinking about how we think about mental illness, how we think about people's ability to recover from mental illness. A quick story I'll tell, where I talk with a woman who had an adult son who lived in her basement. He was maybe 30 years old. He'd been released from the state hospital, and he lived in the basement, smoked cigarettes, watched TV all day. From a traditional system standpoint, he would be considered a success. Why? Because he wasn't in a hospital, he wasn't in jail, he wasn't homeless, he wasn't bothering anyone. He didn't want that for himself, his mother didn't want that, we don't want that for people. What we want is what you see and you heard from Pat's stories, that people reach their full potential. Everyone's not going to get a PhD, but people can have a meaningful life in the community. And what the recovery movement is about, and the reframing of our service systems around that idea, is really focusing on that as the outcome, not the maintenance, management of symptoms, but really helping people to get to their level of their highest level of potential as a person.
Sounds great in theory. What's that look like?
Well, it's not just theory. It is
right.
There's a lot of research behind it. As Pat said, that the research consistently shows that about 2/3 of the people who have even the most serious forms of mental illness will recover. And that's not the way most practitioners are trained. That's not what the public believes. It's not how we have set public policy. And so a big part of our job is re-engineering our service systems so that they get a different set of outcomes, not just maintenance and symptom management, but true recovery.
So tell me about that guy in the basement who's smoking cigarettes.
Okay. Well, I actually don't know what happened to him. That was a story that was relayed to me when I was the deputy commissioner in Connecticut. Since I've been here, and we had actually started this work in Connecticut as well, we've really been working hard to create an expectation that that person can work, that that person can go back to school if that's what they want to do, that that person doesn't have to be confined to a basement but can be a part of the community. And so we've spent a lot of our energy in, again, re-engineering our services so that that's the outcome. Every system is wonderfully designed to get the outcomes that it has. And so if we want a different set of outcomes, we're going to have to re-engineer our services so that we are working towards those outcomes. And we have lots of great examples. One of the things I'm most proud of in my tenure as commissioner here is that we have literally hundreds of people who not only have engaged in recovery in the way that Pat has described, but who are vocally and visibly relaying that to their peers and to the broader community.
So tell us about, you've got a program apropos of this for homeless people.
We do. So one of the challenges that we have in this country is that there are too many people who have mental illness who live on the streets of our cities and our suburbs all over the country. And it's a big public health issue, big public health challenge for us. Most often people look at those situations and they say, well, that's a failure of the mental health system. I think it's much more complex. When people when people live on the streets and don't have housing, the issue is that they don't have housing. So you can provide all the treatment that you want. If you don't have housing at the end of the day, it doesn't work. And so one of the things we've done in Philadelphia is to, by partnering with the Philadelphia Public Housing Authority, working with the Deputy Mayor for Health and Opportunity, Don Schwartz, and other people, my colleague in the Office of Supported Housing, we've created a whole system to work with individuals by doing outreach into the community, connecting them to services that have been redesigned for people who are homeless. Mm. Traditional services don't work for people who've lived on the street for a very long period of time. And one of the key innovations is that we're using something called Housing First. So traditionally, we might have gotten those people off of the streets, gotten them into a treatment program, and hopefully if they went through all the steps, they could eventually end up in supported housing. Now our approach is to get people directly into housing and support them in housing, and that seems to be much more effective at engaging people and keeping people off the streets. So, and just to give you an example, over the last 4 years, we've gotten over 1,000 people who have formerly been homeless off of the streets of Philadelphia by changing the approach that we've taken historically.
Yeah, I remember one of my first supervisors, and I was working in Southwest Philadelphia, and he said, "You're not going to help people's anxiety about hunger until you feed them."
Exactly.
You're not going to work. Right. You're not going to work on anxiety.
Right. And you're not going to end homelessness unless you have housing.
Exactly. Exactly. We've got to take a short break. Pat, you're going to be able to stay with us?
Sure.
Good. And when we come back, we're going to hear from a young woman I mentioned earlier, Molly Kreider, who is really forward-thinking. She came up with a new way of helping those with mental health diagnoses take care of their treatment, continue their treatment. And we'll discuss the recovery movement in greater detail. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about innovations in the mental health, behavioral health movement here in Philadelphia and nationally, and there is an awful lot going on and pretty exciting stuff. We're here with Arthur Evans here in the studio. He's commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. Pat Deegan, we spoke with earlier. She's still with us. She does research and lectures on the topic of recovery and empowerment. Her web application is called Common Ground. I'm also joined now by Molly Kreider Viscardi. She's a student in the School of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania. She and three others won this year's Penn Public Policy Challenge for a tool that helps people remember their follow-up care appointments. And we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. What innovations have you experienced? What has changed for you? And what innovations would you like to see? 888-477-9499. Arthur, I want to follow up with you before we get to what Molly created. We're talking about unique interventions for the homeless, and the traditional ones don't work. So as a clinician, educate me.
Sure. So one of the things that we typically do in systems is we, once we create a program, we expect people to fit into that program. And actually one of the key concepts of the recovery approach is to look at the person first and design programs around the person. And so if you take people who are homeless, who've lived on the streets, who have not had a lot of structure in their day-to-day life, asking those people to go into a highly structured program just doesn't work. And so, for example, one of the programs that we've changed are our residential treatment programs so that when people come into those programs, the programs are designed around them as opposed to them being...
For example?
So, for example, a typical program might have You get up for breakfast at this time. You go to group. You do this. You do that. And we asked those providers to redesign those programs so that when people came through the doors, they asked people, how did you want to spend your day, for example? And so the people in the programs talk about what their needs are, and the programs are designed around them. And what we have found in taking that approach is, whereas we may have, most people may have gone to, say, a residential drug treatment program for maybe 1 week or 2 weeks before they left, we have people who have lengths of stay for 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, long enough for us to work with them and really prepare them for moving into more independent living.
So you actually ask them how they want to spend
their day. That's a radical idea for our field, but yes, we actually ask people what they want and then work with them through that lens. And it makes all the difference. You know, one of the big challenges, just to give you a quick example, one of the big challenges we have is that people leave treatment pretty quickly. The modal number of outpatient visits, for example, is one. Most people who go to outpatient treatment only have one session.
Well, that leads us to Molly Kreider-Viscardi here. Hey, Molly.
Hello.
First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
On the award. So your group's motto was think big and start small. So tell us about your project.
Sure. Thank you. So as you said, last year I was part of the public policy challenge run by the Fell School of Government at Penn. And it's a competition to promote civic engagement and interdisciplinary collaboration among the different schools at Penn, and to get Penn students into the local community, looking at the issues that the community faces and hopefully solving them. So I got together, I'm a nurse and a nursing student, with a med student, a social work, and a policy student. And we had a lot of big plans at first. And we knew we wanted to do something having to do with mental health. We looked at getting police to enforce mandated outpatient treatment. We looked at creating more just these very, very big ideas. And we were repeatedly told, I'm not sure you can do that as four students in the time frame of the competition. So one of the problems that we had identified is a lot of people don't even make it. A lot of patients discharged from inpatient psychiatric services don't make their first outpatient appointment.
How did you get there?
We cast a very wide net, and we looked at especially the social work student who was working at Belmont Hospital. I work in an emergency department. I work at Jefferson. So we sort of had a list of problems that go on and on and on and on, and we were really looking for a problem that might have a solution. So one of the problems that the social work students saw was that outpatient providers are very frustrated because they're showing up for work and the patients aren't coming. And the patients that don't come, it's sort of a waste of time, it's a waste of resources, and also they want to help those patients, and those patients aren't getting the services that they really need and deserve. So we were looking for a way to get patients to that first appointment. Research shows if they get to that first appointment, they're more likely to get the medications that they need. They're less likely to be rehospitalized. So once we focused in on that problem, we looked for a solution. There's a lot of research about reminders, and typically reminders are these postcards that you get from your dentist, but within the last 5 or 10 years, text message reminders have been very effective. I get one from my hairdresser personally. And it's been shown that in this population of recently discharged patients who are receiving care for their mental illness, text messages work even better. And so there's a study from the UK that shows that these patients are 30% more likely with two text message reminders after they're discharged to make that first appointment. Obviously, not all of them stay in care, but some of them will stay in care and stay out of the hospital.
Text messages. Now, Arthur's just been talking about homeless people, and I imagine a lot of the people who get discharged from psychiatric wards or mental hospitals aren't online.
Yes. Great question. And that was one that we got. So we went through 3 rounds of this competition. That was a question that we got a lot. And first, I would say, working as a nurse, there are a lot of people that have cell phones that don't have other basic services that I've seen. And also there are social programs. The FCC has a program that anyone who receives any social services is eligible for a cell phone with 250 minutes a month. And this is a program that not a lot of people know about, and not a lot of patients are getting hooked up with this service in the hospital. So one piece of our policy initiative is we hope to get social workers to sign up patients for cell phones. Cell phones are incredibly important in our society right now. I mean, it's hard to have a job without a phone number. So we think giving these patients a cell phone and some minutes can help them in other areas of their life as well.
Any other vehicles besides texting?
We looked at emails, too, although that seems like something that people do even less. There's a problem, especially in this community. There's mobility issues, and so having one basic home address is less likely. And we really think, based on research and talking to people, that cell phones are the way to go.
I read in going over your project, I read that in Philadelphia, 11,000 people each year are admitted to psychiatric inpatient units, and when they're discharged, I read they're given a stack of papers, and somewhere embedded in that stack of papers is an outpatient appointment. It's really no surprise. The number, 42% of people discharged don't return for their first appointment. So what happens to those who don't return and those who do return?
Well, we are not exactly sure, because patients who don't go to their first appointment, we know are more likely to be readmitted. We don't know if those patients made it to their first appointment, if they would take perfect care of themselves and not be readmitted, but we think so. So what we'd like to do is make sure that everyone is getting an outpatient appointment. This is one, this is a quality initiative that's already going on in the city. They want everyone to have an outpatient appointment by the time they leave the hospital. But we also want to make sure it's an appointment that they can make. I mean, if they're working and you give them an appointment Tuesday at 11 on the other side of the city, you know, who knows? And we don't know if people are speaking up and saying, well, if you made me an appointment on another day of the week or in my neighborhood, I would go.
That kind of gets back to that bizarre idea that Arthur Evans had about actually asking people.
Yes.
Strange. I think in Sanskrit they call that respect. I think, yeah. Yes. I want to bring you back here, Arthur, and Pat Deegan, too. What do we know about people who don't make that first appointment? Do we know numbers?
Well, it's a high number, and one of the things we're doing is, as a payer, as a public payer, is making sure that our providers, hospitals and outpatient providers, know that this is a big issue. And in fact, one of the things that Citi is doing is something called pay for performance. So we pay our providers. Our providers can earn a performance payment based on their performance around things like continuity of care, which is making sure that people connect from, say, hospital level of care to an outpatient level of care. What's interesting about that is when we first went to the hospitals and told them that the only way that they could make this get this performance payment was to improve their continuity to outpatient, most of them said, well, we really don't have anything to do with that. You know, once we discharge someone, we don't have a lot to do with that. After the first year, the provider who was at the bottom of the distribution, who didn't get a performance payment, the very next year was at the very top of the distribution. So financial incentives, in addition to the kinds of things that Molly was talking about, can be very powerful in shaping behavior and improving those kinds of outcomes.
Well, wait a minute. As a provider, I want to push back and say, wait a minute, you're making me take responsibility for something. How can I take responsibility for somebody else's behavior outside when they're outside of these walls?
Well, and I think that's the point. I think that people and providers do have much more control over these kinds of, and certainly influence, I should say, over these kinds of situations than historically people have accepted. When I was running inpatient programs, I had protocols and relationships with outpatient providers. They came onto the unit before people left. We had protocols in terms of what information I would share with the provider before the person would arrive. So there are all kinds of things that people can do. And I think the anecdote of the provider who was at the bottom of the distribution 1 year and was at the top the very next, because now the financial incentives were in place, I think highlights the fact that there are many things that we can do to innovate and to make practice and service delivery better.
Hmm. Pat, I want to come back to your innovation there. Do you have any research follow-up? How's it doing?
Sure. So the Common Ground web application is being used in about 52 sites around the country right now. And these sites include traditional mental health centers with medication clinics, also subacute inpatient units, as well as mobile treatment teams, such as assertive community treatment teams. And people who are using the Common Ground web application are helped to discover what we call their personal medicine, things they can do to help themselves. Because those of us with the lived experience of recovery know that swallowing pills is really not going to get us the life and recovery that we want to live. It's by changing our lives, not just our biochemistry. So personal medicines are the things we do to get well and stay well. And most of us find that the pathway into recovery is by finding the right balance between what we call pill medicine and personal medicine. And that's important in terms of the studies that we've been doing, because what we found is this notion that you have to do more than simply swallow pills. You have to get active. Examples of personal medicines are things like, taking my dogs out for a walk every day is powerful personal medicine. It's an antidepressant. It elevates my mood. It helps my psychiatric medicines work even better.
It's also pretty good for your dog, Pat.
It's great for the dog. And so for instance, what we found is that this idea of personal medicine really begins to engage people. And as they use Common Ground at each time that they come into med clinic, you see their individual's use of personal medicine becoming more robust and increasing over time. Also, as people are engaging in this process of talking with their doctors in a more collaborative way that emphasizes shared decision-making about treatment, people have fewer complaints about side effects, feel that the medications they're being prescribed are more effective in helping them with what they want help with, and also that people are less concerned about how the meds are affecting their physical health. And these are really important findings that all point to this critical factor called engagement and activation.
So
the Common Ground appears to engage and activate the very people that you're saying sometimes who don't show up at clinic, right?
So what you're really talking about here is how the brain, the environment, and the psychology all blend in together. They can put you in a downward spiral, or, they can nurture one another and help get you out of where you are. I think it's an elegant and beautiful blend of all three of those, and all three really have to be working together. When we come back, we got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take some of your calls, and I want to follow up on this respect issue and talk about the human side of those who carry these diagnoses. We're talking with Arthur Evans, Commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health, Pat Deegan, on the phone. She developed a web application called Common Ground and received the Scattergood Foundation's 2013 Innovation Award. Molly Kreider-Viscardi is here in the studio with us. She's working on her doctorate in nursing at University of Pennsylvania, and she also won a public policy challenge for these tools. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why?
Do you need to write things down to remember them? If this sounds familiar to you, you may qualify for a research study focusing on cognition and memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We are talking about innovations in behavioral health here in the city of Philadelphia and nationally. Arthur, here we have the Scattergood and Fells Institute giving out awards. We're talking about the recovery movement, and you're really the prime mover here. Is Philadelphia becoming a hub of sorts for innovation in behavioral health care? There really is an awful lot going on here.
Yeah. Well, we like to think so. But, you know, the history of Philadelphia goes back to Benjamin Rush, who's the father of American psychiatry. He was here in Philadelphia. So the city has a long list of firsts, and a lot of those have been in behavioral health, and I think we're carrying on that tradition right now.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting here. Pat, I want to come back to you. I saw a woman with mental illness interviewed after she had been through some treatment, and she said the most painful part of the process is when people stepped over her or talked to whoever she was with. She felt so invisible, and, you know, I don't know if anybody told you, I'm a quadriplegic, and often I do too. You know, I'll go into a restaurant and the hostess will talk to the person I'm with, and so that's the most painful part, is that alienation. Did you experience that?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, the way I talk about it is like wearing kind of scarlet leather. It's as if the term schizophrenia took on like a master status in terms of my identity. And all the other things that I was and did and who I was seemed to be absolutely eclipsed, overshadowed by this diagnosis. And that's very dehumanizing. It's mortifying.
Yeah, you didn't have schizophrenia. You were a schizophrenic. It's like I was a quadriplegic. That was our identities. Arthur, tell us what's happening here. This whole recovery movement really has implications about the way we see people.
Oh, it absolutely does. And, you know, we're very careful about language. I don't use the... eliminate the word schizophrenic out of my vocabulary,
right.
And we ask people in our system to do the same, and use what we call people-first language. I think it has a big impact on how we look at people, how we look at what the possibilities are for people. When you're a schizophrenic versus a person with schizophrenia, really limits how we think about what people's potential and possibilities are. So I think, you know, the whole recovery framework, and I call it a movement, a framework, is really about how we see people as people and people with conditions that are treatable and see the potential for people. On the one hand, that's simple. On the other hand, that's very complicated, because all of our training as psychologists and psychiatrists is based on that. The way we finance our services is based on that.
Go after symptoms.
Go after symptoms. And so we've spent nearly a decade really reframing and redoing our service system so that people are focused on treating people, asking people about what they want, about working with people from that framework, and about trying to get the outcomes that people want.
Apropos of what recovery is, let's go to the phones here. We've got Mark on the line. Hey, Mark.
Yeah. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I'm very interested in this. I've been diagnosed with bipolar disease, or disorder, excuse me. And I'm curious what your guests mean by recovery clinically.
So for me, and Pat can jump in here as well, but for me it means moving away from just thinking about what the symptoms of bipolar illness are, which is what typically we focus on in our mental health system. So the criteria for admission to treatment and the criteria for discharge when you're ready to leave treatment is really based on your symptoms. From a recovery standpoint, what we're more interested in is how people are functioning. Are people able to work? Are people able to go back to school? Are people able to do those kinds of things that we think are important? If I broke my leg, I wouldn't be happy with just my leg mending. I'd want to be able to run and to walk and to do those things that I did prior to my leg being broken. In a similar way, when people have schizophrenia or some other major mental illness, it's not just enough for them to not have those symptoms, but it's how do we help people to return and have the kind of life that they want to have?
Mark, is that clear for you?
It is. There's a second part of my question, though, and that's for me, I kind of feel like I'm sort of in a donut hole in a way where I would consider myself, by your definition, sort of in recovery, and yet these symptoms continue to, you know, affect my life adversely. I've found it difficult to find healthcare providers and certainly find healthcare providers that can, you know, deliver some of these innovative services. I've found providers that, you know, make it harder for me to function on a daily level, getting to school, helping take care of my family, things like that. So I would just like to hear your comments on those people who are sort of in between, you know, going into a residential treatment center and then going through this recovery framework versus someone who has full health care coverage and so forth and then ends up sort of
Mark, I have a feeling you're in a donut hole. I have a feeling it is a very, very, very large donut hole with lots of people in it. Arthur, I want to hear you and Pat, I want to hear you both weigh in on this.
Sure. I think this is a great question. And I think that there are at least two aspects of it. One is even though we talk about symptoms not being the primary focus, symptoms and addressing symptoms are very important. That's what we're paid to do as clinicians. So we really believe in using empirically supported treatment, evidence-based practices. We're working with people like Aaron Beck, who's the father of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the most effective psychotherapeutic techniques that we have in the field today. Also a Philadelphian. Because we do believe and understand that symptoms are important. Our position is that symptoms aren't the only thing that's important and that there are other pieces. And so what I would really encourage you to do is to find practitioners that are using empirically supported treatment, evidence-based treatments, because we think that that's really important in helping people to have the best shot at recovery. But I also think that you want to have providers who are oriented to ask those kinds of questions about what your goals are and work with you around those.
Wait a minute. Now, Mark's not online anymore, so I'm going to channel him.
Sure.
All right. Everything you said sounds great, mm-hmm. but you're asking me to do that? Me to find providers who practice evidence-based treatment? I have no idea what you're talking about, with all due respect.
Absolutely. And so, but I think it's what Pat was talking about earlier, which is we don't want people to be passive recipients of services.
Right.
People have to be active participants in their own health and their own health care. And I think if you want to get well, you're going to have to do some of that homework. Now, certainly at the department, we can help. I would encourage people to use our Healthy Minds Philly website, which is a website that where we have mental health screening and other resources that can connect you to services. But there are lots of resources out there. We try to make ourselves available as a resource and use our websites and other things for that.
And we'll get them up on our website too at whyy.org/voices. I want to come back to you, Molly. You're going to award of $25,000, and you and your group. And before I ask you what you're going to do with that award, I just wanted to remind you that our fundraiser's coming up right around the corner, and you got an extra $25K. I just want to mention that.
Noted.
So, are you going to continue with this, with innovations around behavioral health?
Yes, continue with this project, certainly. People have asked me, oh, so are you getting involved in something else? Well, no, we still have a very long way to go until this project is a reality. We've incorporated as a nonprofit, and we're working with CBH Community Behavioral Health to actually implement this project. And so we're spending a bulk of our money on actually developing the website. So this website will send text messages, but also collect data that then we can use to see these patients are getting a reminder. Are they going to their appointment? If they're going to their appointment, are they being readmitted? Are they using other services?
Is there a vehicle that's going to help them get to their subsequent appointment? Or will there be in the future when you win your next $50,000.
Yes. So we've taken to calling our project a cascading intervention, and we hope that we can first just text all those 11,000 patients who are being discharged, and then use the data that we get back to make targeted interventions, such as some patients might respond really well to text messages, maybe younger patients, maybe more used to texting. So maybe we can target those patients and send them medication reminders, and maybe that will be a helpful.
So you are still thinking.
Definitely it. Still thinking.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. It's so good to hear, and it's so good to hear what's happening in the field. You've, Molly, you've made me happy. Yeah. Pat, you've made me happy, and so have you, Art, but you always do, Arthur.
Well, you always make me happy.
I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. It's been a really informative show and a real good one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about innovation in the field of behavioral health with Arthur Evans Jr., Patricia Deegan, and Molly Kreider Viscardi. Next week on Voices in the Family, we will be talking about deadlines. We love them. We hate them. Do we need them? And what do they really do for us, if anything? Well, we'd love to hear from you. Like I said earlier, we're at whyy.org/voices. We're going to have lots of information up there for you. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And, of course, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Welcome back, Emily. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.